from Michael R. Underwood, author of Geekomancy, Shield and Crocus, and more, comes Genrenauts, a science fiction adventure series in novellas. Fantasy, mystery, science fiction. We know these genres from TV and comics and more, but in Genrenauts, each genre is also a world unto itself, inhabited by archetypal characters and filled with the tropes we all know and love. When stories go off track, you send in the Genrenauts. This team of narrative specialists travels across dimensions to find, evaluate, and fix broken stories, lest the ripples manifest as violence and upheaval in our own world. Struggling stand-up comedian Leah Tang is recruited to join the Genrenauts as stories are breaking at a record pace. Will she adapt to the bizarre and dangerous life of a Genrenaut, or will she end up as just another broken story? From May 9th to June 9th, Genrenauts is kickstarting a Season 1 collected edition comprising all six novellas. Head to michaelrunderwood.com/kickstarter today to back the campaign and help shape the future of Genrenauts.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
Somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? Get cornered, bash him in the head. That seems to work out.
I mean, what are we, a team? No. We're a chemical mixture that makes chaos.
Gentlemen, I'm Agent Carter. I supervise all operations for this division.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
And
angels are love!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
Babylon 5, Season 2, Episodes 1 to 4. Meet the new boss, not the same as the old boss.
Paul.
I think I hit the button already.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to talk about Babylon 5, Season 2, Disc 1, which is the first four episodes. And it's been a while since we've done this. We haven't done a Babylon 5 in a while. We said we were going to do it last year and that we didn't do it because things happened. And so now we're finally getting back to it. So this should be, it should be a big, interesting thing given that I am still watching fresh. I have not watched it all and come back around. So I'm still the noob. So yeah. So why don't we just want to dive in? Just want to go for it, guys?
Well, maybe we want a very quick recap of what Babylon 5 is and where things stand for listeners who might not be aware of what's going on.
Well, I will leave that to the experts. So if you guys want to rock, paper, scissors it, and then we'll decide who goes.
Yeah, Mike, you're me.
Oh, sure. So this is a science fiction television series created by J. Michael Straczynski and almost exclusively written by Straczynski, directed by a variety of people. It was on from, I think, 1993 to 1998 or so, if Paul, you can check me on that.
Season 2 is 94, so yeah, Season 1 is 93, so yeah, that sounds right.
And it is often discussed in science fiction circles because of its long arcs and because it was designed as a five-season story. Straczynski has talked about it as being a novel for television. So it's more deeply serialized than a lot of television, and I think we can see its influence structurally on shows that follow. It's one of my favorite shows, and Paul, I know, is a big fan as well. So we have a couple of people who are experienced with the show, and Sean brings a new perspective. Paul, do you want to do a quick end of season recap so we know where we are?
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So season one introduced the main characters of the show and the concept of Babylon 5 as this 23rd century Earth space station in neutral territory, dealing with aliens, trying to solve conflicts, and trying to be the last best hope for peace. As season one progressed, conflicts between a couple of the races started to threaten to flare up, and revelations about what had happened in the Earth-Minbari War 10 years prior were starting to slowly bubble to the surface, revealing that things were definitely not what they seemed. By the end of the season, we had our Earth Alliance president get blatantly assassinated, although that's clearly been covered up, and it clearly that the big revelation was that the two big revelations that A, there's a force out there that Londa Mollari is starting to tap into that has vast military power, and Minbari souls are being reborn into humans. No joke. And so we start season two. Oh yes, and the Minbari ambassador went into cocoon at the end of season one for to be revealed in these four episodes, and then we start season two.
And Mr. Garibaldi, our security chief, was shot in the back, and his fate unknown at the end of the season.
Oh, yes, that's right. Path back
and banger. Kind of an important detail. And, you know, just some other little things like Londo's whole deal with this mysterious group.
Well, yeah, that was the military force, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that about covers it. So why don't we just dive in with the first episode, shall we?
Points of Departure.
Yeah, so Points of Departure is our introduction to this new series. And I say introduction because there's a big change. And that's the change that bugs the hell out of me.
Oh, which boy.
Is that my sweet love from this show, Sinclair, is no longer here. And as much as I love Boxleitner, I prefer Sinclair.
Yeah, because they bring a really different style and energy to the show. Because for me, Sheridan is a lot more, at the beginning, he's very much kind of smiley, and my wife calls him Captain Chuckles, because he's very, interesting, and I have thoughts about this, and here's some philosophy, and like the philosophizing is kind of in common with Sinclair, but Boxleitner's performance is very different than what we got for Sinclair in season one. And all of his relationships to the key characters in the show are different in that he has non-existent relations with some people, but he does have this history with Ivanova.
Yeah, a military history because they served together at a previous venture. Yeah.
Yep.
And of course, Sinclair, his absence is explained as he has been granted as an ambassador to Minbari, and I believe he's the first human to ever be brought to their world. Like, well, presumably first one brought there on purpose.
Right, as an official in a diplomatic relationship.
Correct, yeah. So that explains his absence. And of course, Sheridan, as we learn in this episode, is asked to basically take on the role at Babylon 5, primarily because in this episode there is a Minbari war cruiser that's going around like some sort of space ghost and freaking people out, and they're worried that it's actually going to spark, what we learn is going to spark essentially a war. To bring back the war between the Minbari and the humans. And that's why Sheridan is placed there, because apparently in his past, he was not very nice to the Minbari. I should say not very nice in the sense that he has one of the few actual victories in the Minbari-human war. Because as we may recall, the Minbari's kicked our ass.
Right. And because the Minbari ships were not able to be tracked or locked by the Earth military ships.
Right.
And the tracking and locking technology that they use for some ships has not even been improved since then. So Sheridan is called the Star Killer because he put proximity mines in an asteroid field and then kind of waited/lured one of the Minbari ships and destroyed, I think, one major ship and a few smaller ships. So like biggest victory. And that earned him quite a lot of hate, especially from the military caste of the Minbari.
Yeah, which I have issues with primarily because, like, everyone seems to hate him as though, like, he did something really horrific, but all he did was destroy one of their ships.
Their flagship.
You're attacking Earth! What the fuck did you think was gonna happen?
So in the notes on the episode on Lurker's Guide, which is a great reference for people who are interested in a lot getting more background on the show, there's the Babylon 5 Lurker's Guide at midwinter.com/lurk. And one of the notes in here is that that intensity of that relation, of that response, it can be pointed at the Minbari's kind of superiority complex. Like, it's the only time they ever got a bloody nose throughout the war. So I think in a more equal war, maybe his heroics wouldn't stand out as much as like and be treated like war crimes in the way that it seems like they are. But like they had a total complete victory, except for that one thing, it seems like.
Just doesn't make any sense.
So, well, but they're also alien, right?
Right, and they're really big on their honor and their own personal sense. So mining an asteroid field and blowing up the flagship, yeah, I can see why the Minbari would take that really badly, even 10 years later.
But they treat him like he killed like an entire planet of Minbari and like murdered they treat him like he committed war crimes.
Yeah,
which makes no sense.
He's the single biggest killer of Minbari in probably generations.
Then don't attack people with ships.
Well,
that's like going up and punching someone in the face and then being mad because they punched you back. You punched him in the face.
Well, I think it speaks to the relativity and the way that the Minbari are kind of constructed as having their own positionality on things, so that they can have responses that we maybe would regard as irrational, but are kind of within their cultural context.
They are aliens.
We'll get to the craziness of aliens later, because there's an episode we'll talk about, which, yeah. But any case, so this episode, as I said, right, so there's this warship called the Trigati that we learn throughout the episode has sort of disappeared at the end of the Earth-Minbari War, and it has come back with the intention of trying to spark things up again, and Sheridan is sent under the guise that, well, he once effed up the Minbari like a tiny little bit. And that's sort of what he's there for, is to defend Babylon 5 and to protect essentially the interests of Babylon 5 by possibly destroying this ship. And in the end, the ship is destroyed, but it is not destroyed in the way which we anticipate it to be destroyed. It's destroyed by another Minbari ship. And it's, of course, destroyed in the act of literally trying to start a war by flying its ships at Babylon 5, attempting to stoke their own destruction, in the guise that it'll lead to the Minbari going, what the hell, and then coming after them again. And instead, the ship is destroyed sort of as a mercy killing by the other Minbari ship, which I found really interesting. This is also our introduction to Sheridan.
That's not the way I read the destruction. The destruction's more, they suicided themselves. I mean, it was a clean hit. The engines had been knocked out, and then they decided to basically self-destruct because all that was left was honor and death.
Yeah, but their whole intent was to die.
Right, so yeah, they killed themselves.
Yeah, but their death doesn't serve the purpose they initially set out to do.
Oh, because, absolutely not.
Yeah, they're right. Essentially disabled by this other ship. So.
Right, because all that was left to them was honor and death, and their attempt at honor was sidelined, so the only option they had left was death.
Yeah, right. Which is an important thing. This is one of the clues that Sheridan picks up on, right? When the Kalane, I think, is the person who tells him, right, all we have is honor and death. And that's one of the major clues he uses to realize that this is not a legitimate attack by a rogue ship. This is a feint to force his hand into killing them, which would then, of course, spark another war with the Minbari. At least right. In theory, that's what it would do, which is probably the case, especially if it's Sheridan. Because that's another clue we learn, is Kalane has learned that Sheridan's come to this ship, which is why he's come to Babylon 5 of all places, why he's essentially come out of hiding.
Right, if there's one if there's one place to pick a fight with the humans.
It's with the one guy that everybody in Minbari kind of hates.
Yep.
Except Delenn, who seems to be like, yeah, it's all right.
Well, because she has a lot more information about how the Earth-Minbar war got started.
Yeah, but we also remember from the previous season, right, she has almost this emotional breakdown over the idea that they're going to wipe out the human race. Like, that freaks her out, the concept of genocide, which is one of her motivations.
She is religious gas, after all. I mean, she's not a warrior.
Right. Right, yeah. So, any case, so thoughts on the episode that aren't mine? So, Mike, maybe you?
Yeah, I think this is a good reminder of the fact that some of these alien subjectivities are going to be harder to understand from the human perspective, and are presumably written to be harder to understand from that perspective, which is kind of tricky because we have a human, our writer, trying to write something that's ununderstandable or is understandable on an intellectual level, but maybe not on an emotional level or vice versa. And that's, these are kind of speak to some of the limitations of the form when we're writing the other, where the other is intended to be so other that sometimes in some ways they are unintelligible.
Fair enough. Now, what I took away from this episode was how this episode very deliberately sets about recapping the first season and getting everybody up to speed quickly. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have a new captain, but here's what happened in the first season. Drop. So then, like, okay, then you can hit the ball running with the rest of the episodes. And theoretically, you could have skipped the entire first season and just started with this. I think we discussed this before we started this project, Sean, because these first few episodes, especially this episode, does a good job in getting up to speed on what's what. But of course, given your affection for Sinclair, you would have missed out on the bulk of the Sinclair stuff in the series right. by skipping season one. He will be back, Sean. I promise.
Don't tell me that.
He will.
Spoilers.
He will
shut
appear
your mouth.
Again.
Just shut your mouth. Don't say anything about what's coming. I want to experience this as clean as I can. Because nobody's talking about Babylon 5 on Twitter. So I'm not going to be ruined by it.
I just imagine if Babylon 5 was running today. Yeah, it would be a Twitter spoil fest.
Yeah, so don't tell me anything about what's coming. I want to come at this completely clean.
Oh, okay, so I have a question for you, Sean, since you're coming to this new. How do you feel about the studio executive meddling character that they introduced in the season? That would be Warren Kepler.
I don't remember him.
He was the pilot.
I don't remember him.
He got inserted into the series basically at studio request because they wanted a hotshot pilot as part of the cast.
But doesn't he show up in the last one?
Yeah, he's in either episode 3 or 4 of this season.
Oh gosh, well, if they inserted him, like it clearly, his character was not interesting enough for me to pay that much attention to him.
They inserted him this season, to try to improve the show.
Yeah, I don't think it worked.
I mean, I saw really ham-handed him sitting there with Ivanova and Franklin at the end of the episode. Like, yeah, you're trying to make him part of the team already. It's not really working.
There's nothing about his character. Like, I honestly don't remember. I remember he existed, but I don't remember, his character's not integrated in any useful way. It's just sort of like, here's a random pilot dude we'll occasionally see again.
Right, because I guess it sort of makes sense to want to have somebody who's a little bit more ground level in their perspective, because even Garibaldi, as the security chief, is privy to a lot of the top-level things, so that the show is mostly a top-down perspective, and that he provides a little bit more of the kind of everyman type of perspective. I don't think that he's terribly well used thus far in the series, and the introduction, as you say, is a bit awkward and be like, yes, he's been there, buddy, the whole time.
Yeah,
no, he hasn't.
Exactly.
He's that guy that in the bar who he knows people and everyone knows him, but then he just shows up and hangs out with you, but you're really uncomfortable and you want him to go away, but you don't have the heart to tell him, just like, we don't want to hang out with you. That's this guy. We all know this person. We met them at a con.
So, other thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I mean, it was fine. It was a fine episode. It sets up everything we need to know about what's going on. We got to see Delenn's weird cocoon, which is bizarre. We'll come to that again.
Yeah, in short order.
So, it's a pretty straightforward episode. It was fine, you know?
Yeah, I think as a repilot style episode, that's not a full repilot in terms of changing format for the show entirely. It does a pretty solid job of introducing things, but so much of what we'll see even later in this first disc is building very explicitly and directly on the individual story beats of season one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it sort of becomes our setup, right, for what is, the second episode very clearly starts to deal with. And maybe some of the other episodes less so. We'll get to the one that I find the most ridiculous a little bit, but not in the next episode, which maybe we should jump to, which is Revelations.
Revelations. Jakar comes back.
Right. So Jakar, who I love Jakar. God.
Yeah, just... and very quickly here we get a different side of Jakar, because he's stared into something really terrible, and it's right. It seems like it's really affecting him here.
Yeah, we get this really great line at one point where Jakar like goes up to Londo and basically says, you know, we're in a situation where I may actually have to ask you for help. And it's...
And Londo's just like taken aback by this. He doesn't know how to process this.
We're all supposed to be, because they've spent the whole last season talking about how much they want to kill each other.
Yep. Yeah, and I think Jakar has been really more openly antagonistic throughout season one. And I think in the season one plots, Jakar, to me, came off as more of the heel, up until we get Londo starting to act at a much higher scale in terms of his calling in that favor for Sector 37 or whatever it was.
Yep.
Right.
And now, like, we have Jakar kind of stares into the abyss and sees that his people are at kind of the edge of a crisis point that's not the one they were expecting. It's not about... the Centauri. It's about this ancient enemy.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a really interesting episode on that front, as well as for... I totally lost my train of thought. I just lost it. I don't know what I was going to say, so I'm just going to delete this out. Somebody else say something intelligible?
Okay, so Jakar's definitely... going through a transformation that, if you had seen the original B5 pilot, where he is the heel, he is the villain. I think that might be a spoiler, since you may not have seen it, Sean. But I'm not going to say anything more about it, because we'll probably watch it at some point. So yeah, and through season one, the Narns are the bully boys. They're the ones pushing around the Centauri, trying to step up until Londo makes his Faustian bargain. And now, after Jakar has come back from Sector 37, he is a changed man and will continue to change as the Narn-Centauri relationship and the relationship of the Narns with this new power evolves and changes. Say more would be really spoiler, so I'm not.
Are you trying to suggest that Morden might be a villain? Is that what you were getting at?
I think you kind of figured that out by now.
I think by this point, if you haven't figured out he's a villain, you're not paying attention.
Or he's got some bad friends.
Yeah, there's nothing about that character where I think, this is a person I trust. Nope. I think every time he talks, I mean, even in this episode, like, this probably is the moment at which you know. Because right after that, he has that conversation with them where Londo and Morden are talking, and Morden basically says, like, well, now that we've done a favor for you, we need a favor in return. And I think that's the moment when Londo either is supposed to realize it, or we realize that he has made a bargain that is going to bite him in the ass, because now he's in their pocket. They can keep asking for favors, and he can't say no. Because if he says no, what do? They maybe reveal what he's been up to.
Or they stop helping him.
Or they stop helping him, or both.
Right, because his growing status in the Centaurum is dependent on that, like, ace in the hole fleet that he deployed, from the Centaurum's perspective. Like, Malari took care of this big thing, and, like, he has all these forces that are in secret. And for the Centauri, who are kind of very, kind of status and what can you do for me oriented, like, it's really bringing his profile up, as we see over the course of these other episodes. For him to cast that aside when he has this great ambition to restore the Centauri, like, that kind of agenda of his has been very evident even from the first episode of the first season. You know, that'd be a huge stepping away from power for him, and that this is not his moment for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, right, he's put himself in a position where he's going down a path and he can't stop down this path because he's already taken the first step. And there's no way of going backwards, which is something he comes up against later on, right? When he has to deal with the techno mage,
yeah.
Right? When he tries to fulfill some sort of absurd like prophecy from it, which we'll come to, I think, later, and it sort of comes back and bites him, right? Because what the techno mage says is, you know, I hear people calling out, and he says, "Oh, my followers," and he says, "No, your victims."
Yeah,
right? And it's like, yeah. because you're going down this path, we all can see it, that is going to lead to immense destruction and pain and suffering, and you don't quite see it. I also really like that Jakar recites poetry in this.
Yep.
Which makes me really happy. I cannot remember what the poem is, but...
it's Yeats.
It's Yeats. Yeah. Yeah, because he says, and I love this little bit, like, Londo doesn't seem to give two shits about anybody else's culture. Like, he'll learn it to the extent that he needs to know it, but, like, he doesn't spend any time on anyone else. Right? He only wants to know what's useful to him. Whereas Jakar is like, I've spent some time studying their literature, and, you know, most of it's kind of garbage, but, like, here's this really interesting one, and then he quotes Yeats. And it's this really interesting passage, which he's directly tying to this darkness that is coming. Because this episode reveals to us possibly what is going to be the major issue that's coming, which is there is this ancient race that the Narn have in their mythology that came and caused immense destruction, and that it's prophesied that they're going to return and wage unimaginable death and destruction again, right? And he thinks that he has seen it on his little trip out there, which went terribly wrong.
Yep.
And in this episode, the Narn Empire sends another ship to confirm.
To Zahadum.
Right, to Zahadum, which sounds like something out of Lord of the Rings, but...
Right.
Very know. Explicitly, yes.
Yeah. And of course, the ship gets destroyed, but it gets destroyed in such a way that it's at that moment between loss of contact that occurs after you come out of a wormhole, right? So he can't confirm that there's anything there rather than maybe a malfunction.
Right, because Jakar is going back to the Book of Jaquan, which is his chosen... historical Narn holy text,
right?
And is like he's convinced that there's this enemy and that they need to band together, and so like he's the person who's like, hey, there's a bigger bad guy, and comes to these other groups, and partially because like Delenn is still out of play at this point because she's just in this episode completing emerging from her chrysalis, so he's making a hard move to try and get the other major races on board. But Londo, he's pissed off, and the humans are skeptical, and the Vorlons are, as they often are, silent. So like he doesn't have anybody who's really listening to him at this point.
Yeah, that's really sad, because like we know Jakar's for real,
right? Because but in season one, Jakar he's kind of protested too much. He's played at the angles. Like he hasn't been a good agent,
right?
Throughout season one. So now when he's doing this thing that he like fervently believes in, and we as the audience know is legit because there was something there, like nobody's listening to him.
Yep.
Yeah.
Boy acquired wolf.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's like, kind of the position he's in. Yeah.
If Delenn had been back by now, you know, maybe her positionality like would change that conversation, but she only emerges toward the end of this episode and she seems very different. As we'll see more later on.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really interested in Sean how you reacted when you saw Delenn.
We'll come to it later.
Okay.
That she doesn't emerge in this. Oh no, this one is the one where she emerges.
She emerges at the end, and that's right. Takes away.
Right. So
yeah, we don't see her final post chrysalis form. I think until next episode.
Is that the one where she's all like creepy weird?
Yeah, because she's like scaly at the either end this episode or beginning of next episode.
Is this the one where Franklin starts to break it off?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, that was weird. It reminded me of that Doctor Who episode with the volcano people. Yeah, that's really what I went to immediately. Like, why is she covered in... It's so bizarre. But yeah, I mean, we'll get to probably her full transformation a little bit.
Right. But later. In this one, we also have Dr. Franklin using the machine from season one. On yes! Garibaldi to bring him back out of this coma. But then Garibaldi doesn't remember who attacked him.
Yeah.
So that's why anybody have a telepath in the house? Oh,
right.
We do.
Yeah. And of course, this episode, we do get that Talia comes in and purges his memory to find the guy guilty.
But then it's not admissible, but they do act on him anyway. So I'm not totally sure about how that works.
It's not made exactly clear, but it also becomes very, it doesn't really matter because he disappears.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah, very convenient.
Yeah, we've got some additional signals that all is not well on Earth Dome.
Definitely not.
Yeah. We also get some of Sheridan here, which I thought was really nice. And I wasn't as convinced by Boxleitner's performance, but part of his ghosts that we haven't learned anything about yet, right? Is that his wife has died, and it becomes a problem for him because in his military experience, right, they don't get to be together very often, right? It's a long distance relationship, as we expect in military.
Yep.
And the thing that drives him sort of gives him so much pain is that he didn't say he loved his wife the last time they spoke. And that, like, he's just feels guilty about that all this time because he thinks it's his fault that his wife has died, right? She dies on a ship that I guess crashes or disappears. I can't remember exactly.
Disappears.
What happened. Yeah. It disappears during a like expedition to go investigate a supposed ancient civilization that is extinct or whatever. Yeah. I'm sure that's going to come back later.
But it's not only going to come back later. This is just a blank detail. When we find out more about his wife and what happened to her, she will be recast at that point. Just so you know. They couldn't get the actress back.
Well,
so they got somebody else, somebody even more appropriate. But that's really spoilery, so I won't say any more about that.
Well, we'll come back to that later. So, all right. So, anything else you want to say about this episode? That was pretty good.
Yeah, it's definitely the first episode was a little episodic in terms of the structure. This one is digging more directly into setup for season arc, and it more feels like what I come to associate as a Babylon 5 kind of episode in the way that it advances several plot lines, a couple of steps.
Yep. A plots, B plots. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So shall we jump to the next episode? The Geometry of Shadows.
Yes. This is a great one.
So I'm going to come out the gate and just say that this episode is 50% ridiculous.
Oh no. Oh, yeah. God, this is awesome. It's ridiculously awesome.
I presume do you mean the Drazi or the Cyber Mages?
Oh, I like the Techno Mages. They're cool. They're fine. I like that whole bit. I get that there's a joke here, right? Which is like these guys have this ridiculous fight, right? That's been going on for centuries, and they fight over what it literally means nothing. And I get that that's supposed to be the joke, but it is also really, really fucking stupid. And I couldn't take it. I just kept going, like, what? Why? Like, at least add something, like the colors are religious or something. Just make it, like, give it a little bit more. But no, they didn't.
I think the thing for me that really stood out, and Meg commented on this because we were watching things together, that there's an escalation during the episode where in the original setup, all the cultural indications and the lore is that these brawls are non-lethal. But then during the episode on the Drazi homeworld, they're like, oh, people have started killing one another. And there's no indication as to why or why this time and not other times other than that's what the plot says. And I think that maybe was doing this alien culture a disservice to not dig into what those implications were. And I don't think that ever really is relevant later. It's just here's an upping the stakes that doesn't really necessarily fit the lore that we've been told.
Yeah, we aren't told why things go, things have gone lethal, and therefore things go lethal on Babylon 5. So that is a weakness of this whole plot. It would have been nice to actually, as you said, Mike, to dig into why is this time different from any other time?
Right. Is it that like the green have always lost for the last century, and they think that it's fate, and they're gonna change the tides of fate, or some way of maybe tying it into something with these new antagonists or something that makes it a little bit more organic and a little bit less of just an overt hard move by the storytellers.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem I had with it is it's just too transparent and there isn't a reasonable logic to what's going on. It's just sort of, here, let's get crazy and we're going to have them killing each other in these elaborate schemes of murder. For why? Because they're purple.
But it does give Ivanova something to do with her new rank, because she gets promoted in this episode and is thrown right into a diplomatic task. She gets, I think, what is it, like foot or ankle broken
Yep.
Yeah, she gets her foot broken.
And she actually got broken in real life at this time, so they changed the script. They wrote it in? Yeah.
That's actually kind of cool. A-plus so writers.
That makes it easier for them to then do what I thought was good storytelling is in the next episode of making sure that her foot is still broken. But that's just, you know, production reality. It's production realities, but they didn't write around it. They let it be. Right?
Interesting. Cool.
Good tidbit, Paul.
Yeah, it is kind of cool that she has, this is her first diplomatic affair, which for her, I guess, is particularly trying because she's a very rational kind of person. And she gets so frustrated with the Drazi when they explain to her how this whole conflict operates and drives her up the wall. It's really what it comes down to. Number of times she just wants to punch them in the face, but she can't do it. And I got some of the humor and it was kind of funny. I did find at the end when she just pulls off, I think, the green shawl or whatever it is and puts it on and all the greens are like, oh, we have to follow you now. And she's like, but I'm not Drazi. And the response is, yeah, the rules don't say it had to be Drazi. It says nothing about who is in charge.
Rule change caught up in committee. Yeah, I think there's a place where this verges on like farce and parody, and that's not necessarily a tone that the show has really worn before.
Yeah,
because like for me, you know, it's very much a like let's make fun of a two-party system, kind of political satire slash parody, which is not really kind of an outfit that the show has particularly worn before, because most of it's played pretty straight, and that there are individual characters who are funny, but not necessarily a whole plot that's funny in this way, if I'm recalling correctly. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, this is the first time we really descend into that sort of tone for this. It's not the last time.
Yeah.
Oh, because I'm thinking of the Penn and Teller episode coming way ahead.
Yeah, but we'll see something funny in this territory later on.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think another issue with it is that because it goes into really into silly territory, I feel like it's they're trying to balance it out with the Technomages, who are much more serious.
Yeah, but that plot line's also silly because of what happens to Londo and what happens
to Veer. The humor of it makes much more sense. Like Londo is like, it's karma has come to bite him in the ass.
Yeah, because there's more cultural context for the Technomages. Right. The Drazi are viewed still as a cipher or as inscrutable, like that there are cultural reasons for having this arbitrary aspect to this festival is never really elucidated. So we don't gain that. I don't think we get the cap on the other end of the tonal range.
Right.
The way that that Sean's describing for the Technomages.
Yeah. And I think that's what like there is. Obviously, the Technomages are a little bit silly, right? He waxes sort of philosophical about the universe and all these kinds of things, but his character's played much more seriously, so the humor that's coming out of it are sort of things that are happening to other characters that we kind of expect to happen, right? Londo trying to manipulate the Technomages to essentially use them to his advantage, and the Technomages tell him, we don't like being used, and the result of that is, well, it's funny for us because we're seeing like Londo suddenly owns like 500,000 shares in like some random mineral that's worthless, right? That's humorous, but it's also, we understand it in the context of Londo, like that would actually piss him off because it would ruin his reputation, right? That he would have all of this garbage money that he's got floating around. So I feel like that the humor's there, but it works on a level that is, it's not farcical. And I don't feel like that works as well in conjunction with the Drazi, which I think are just a little too silly. But that's my only big issue with this. Otherwise, I actually really like the Technomages.
Yeah, they're I think a fun bit, and they build on the mysticism of the setting because this show does a fair amount with religion and mysticism among the various alien races, which I appreciate because a lot of SF just moves, kind of leans away from religion.
Yeah, I agree. It shows us yet another side to the non-straight scientific side of the world, that there is mystery and wonder and faith and belief and what what's lying out there in the dark and what he believes lying out there in the dark. And the Technomages encapsulate that very well. And I loved Veer's reaction to the demon. He's just speaking at him, even though the demon's leering at him. He's like, after working for long, though, nothing bothers you. It's like,
yeah.
good, solid Veer. Technomages can't scare him off.
They respect him, though. They respect Veer. Like, he doesn't lie to them. He just sort of is very straight. And they're not going to do what Veer came to get done, but they sort of seem to respect Veer's tenacity, which they don't with Londo, because Londo is a manipulating, lying bastard. Right? I mean, that scene when he puts the little recorder down trying to be all sneaky, the Technomage knows it's there the whole time, and he's basically set a trap for her, Londo. And it doesn't go terribly well. But I do find it really interesting that Michael Ansara, who plays the Technomage Elric, of course, another reference,
yep,
is a Syrian-born American actor, which I find really interesting because in his career, apparently, he got typecast as playing a Native American, which
Hollywood
is not exactly how that works, but okay, Hollywood.
We have Ricardo Montalban playing a South Asian Sikh and so on and so forth.
Right, exactly. And I do really, though, I love his performance as the Technomage, as Elric, because he just has this gravitas, like the way he talks.
Yeah.
You believe him, or you believe like he really has this weird vision of the world, and like he does make magic out of tech. It's really cool.
He's a heavy in the setting as well as being a heavy in terms of the way we classify actors.
Yeah.
He was on an episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and he was, of course, on the original Star Trek.
Oh, nice.
Really?
He was one of the Klingon commanders. Didn't you know that?
Oh, I could totally see him as a Klingon.
There's a note on the Unlurkers for that as well. Yeah, it's cool when we get these kind of callbacks and cross-property intertextuality bits.
Yeah, but when you see him as a Technomage, I could see him as a Klingon.
Yep. Uh-huh, yeah.
He just has that voice. All we need to do is make him angry, which he doesn't really have here, right? He doesn't get to be angry. He is mad, but
he's more disappointed and frustrated.
Yeah.
I could kill you, but another would take your place.
Yeah, that kind
so
of
I
thing.
Do all
yeah.
I can do, I go.
Yeah, because like here Elric is kind of talking. He's almost talking in archetypes that like the role that he sees Malari filling is a role that someone will fill, even if it's not Malari the individual, which I think speaks both to kind of his view of the thing that's coming, but also that Malari's choices are his own, but that he's fitting into a certain type.
Yeah, and I think it's also really important to note, too, that the reason we're introduced to the... So the two reasons we're introduced to the Technomages. One is it's an excuse for Londo, who has just learned that he may be the one that's being supported to become the new emperor back home, right? Because there's a coup that's about to be ordered, essentially. And so all of the things we talked about before, right? Londo's done all these things which are make him look really good on the Centauri homeworld. And part of what led to the emperor that they have now, I guess, getting into power was a meeting with these Technomages. They met with these three Technomages. So it becomes like this mythology, right? This idea that it's an omen. And unfortunately, it doesn't go terribly well for Londo. The other reason is that the Technomages are there on Babylon 5 on their way to a destination that they won't reveal, but we do know that they're trying to escape a conflict that is coming, which they won't tell us about. Which we can, I'm guessing I can see what the conflict is. They're running from the thing that everyone else should be running from, but I don't know it's coming yet. And I think that's so it's really interesting. We get these mystical beings that are both really central to this narrative we're going to keep getting, but also are like extricating themselves from all of it. They don't want to be involved in it. They want to be gone. And even when, right, Sheridan tries to get the Technomage to like tell him information, the Technomage, like you said, Mike, like he speaks almost like riddles, kind of, right? These philosophical riddles. He won't give him these straight answers, and probably for a good reason. I also really like that Londo asked the Technomage whether he's going to pay for that mistake, the mistake he made by trying to bug the Technomage and pissing him off. And the Tetna Mage says that you're not going to pay forever for this mistake, but you will pay for every all the other mistakes you're going to make. You're going to pay for so many mistakes. That's not the exact wording. I think the wording is you're going to pay forever, just not for this mistake, is I think what he said, which should be Londo's clue that maybe he should be going down a different path. But of course, he can't, right? He has this pride about him. He loves his people that much. He wants to lead them to greatness, which is was kind of one of the conflicts in the previous narrative, right? Trying to make the Centauri Empire bigger and better as it was before the sort of separation and the Narn became their own people. But Londo's kind of an idiot.
Well, but he's not only kind of an idiot, but Mr. Morden chose him very carefully and deliberately.
Right, because he came to everybody.
Yep.
And he interacted with everybody as much as they would with him. And only Mollari came back to him, or kind of reconsidered at the end of that conversation that they had.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, all right, so we got one more to go.
Yeah, and then, like, so by the end of this third episode, I think Delenn is out and reveals herself, kind of her new form. Is that correct, or is that in the next episode? Because I think she presents herself to the council at the end of episode 3 of this season.
Yeah, she does. If I recall correctly, that's correct.
So here she has a much more human-like, humanoid appearance with hair, ears in a kind of a more human space than the like kind of below ridge space that Lanier and the other ones do. And that this transformation she talks about as kind of making her a bridge between peoples. Which, since we've seen the talk about, like, souls being shared between these races, like, this is an interesting thing, but it's, like, very its own thing. It's not like, oh, yes, we've decided, like, it doesn't seem to me at this point, like, that this is a thing that happens a lot between races. Yeah, it seems more like Delenn had kind of an old ritual book from some connections with the religious caste. And she thought that this was the right time for her to need to be able to do this kind of bridging with humanity because of reasons.
Yeah, and I do think that this is since we're talking bridges, this will bridge us into episode 4 anyway.
Yeah.
I think it's really fascinating that the first thing she's questioned about by her own people is whether or not she's one of them. Right? They actually question whether or not she is still Minbari. Right, which I think is really, really an important detail here because, she has had this, like, I mean, I think at one point Londo even jokingly says in maybe episode 1 or 2, right, that like she's essentially going through a process like a butterfly.
Yeah.
Right. And that's precisely what's happened, right? She's had this enormous transformation. It may seem very subtle to us, right? But to her own people, right, her transformation's massive. Right, she's changed physical appearance, and they don't know what the other changes actually are. And that's the big question, right? If those changes are much more significant than we originally anticipated, you may not even be one of us anymore.
Right,
and the kind of xenophobia sets in.
Yeah, because especially like that, as it counterpoints the Minbari souls being reborn into humans,
right,
and the relationship that humanity has, like a very fraught but protected relationship because of the Great Council. And, you know, I was like, okay, so this changes a lot of her relationships, because where Delenn was pretty stable and high ranking as a representative at Babylon 5 previously, and Jakar sort of, Londo less so, like now her status and her relationships are kind of under threat.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. So, but we do need to move on to the 4th episode.
Yeah, 4th episode, so, Distant Star.
So this last episode on Disc 1 of Season 2 is a Distant Star. Distant Star, the basic premise of it is there is an Earth Force Explorer class ship called the EAS Cortez, which happens to have a captain on it that is friendly with John Sheridan. They guess old friends. Essentially, the ship gets caught at the end of it into the wormhole, kind of falls out as it's after its resupply, and there you have to mount a daring rescue, and so they do. And this is also, as we mentioned, right, this is the episode in which Delenn is being questioned about her Minbari-ness, Minbarity?
Yeah, Minbarity.
Minbarity, I guess, I don't know. Anyway, that we get that. We also have... I think there's some more stuff. Oh, Dr. Franklin telling everybody what they're allowed to eat.
Oh, yeah.
Which is one of those things, like, when the show is being humorous, but, like, it's sort of that backdrop, I really like it because it's about character building.
I am the expanding Russian frontier.
Yeah. Yeah, because for me, this bit of comedy fits more in the rest of the show.
Yes,
yeah,
it does.
It's not that slapsticky, over the top. Yeah, that we
it's
got
sort
with
of
the Drazi.
Background, right? It's there, and it's part of the character building. It's about developing their characters.
Exactly.
Like, there's that hilarious scene when it's Sheridan,
Ivanova, and
is it Garibaldi? He's there.
Yeah.
And so, like, they've got their foods that they're supposed to eat, and it's like she's got, because she doesn't eat enough of the stuff she's supposed to eat. So she's got, like, Alfredo or something like that, some spaghetti Alfredo thing. Garibaldi's got meatloaf and steamed vegetables. And Sheridan has
this is like a salad.
And there's this funny moment where they're, like, switching them around towards right at the end of the episode, right? And then Franklin comes up, like, looking over their shoulder as to switch them around. But I think it was interesting because, like, the only one of those that's really kind of the quote-unquote unhealthy meal is Ivanova's, right? It's just cream, right? It's not like there's no vegetables
in it. Yeah,
but everyone else has these healthy meals. And it's just, I don't know. I found it really funny. But then, of course, at the end of the episode, right, Franklin basically investigates why Garibaldi is doing all this secret stuff in the shipping area. And it's because he didn't want Franklin to know he was bringing in the stuff to make this old food.
Bagnacotta.
I don't know what that actually is, but I'm sure it's delicious. That his dad used to make. All right. And
we can include the recipe for Bagnacotta from the Lurker's Guide in the show notes, because I have it here.
Yes, please give that to me. Yeah. But anyway, so, like, Franklin finds out about it, and Garibaldi gives this really heartwarming talk to him, right, about, you know, what he made and how and all this kind of things and why it's really important to him. And Franklin says, well, you better make it for two because I'm coming along. And then they eat. And there's this really cute moment when Franklin's like, this is really delicious. And Garibaldi's like, yeah, just wait till dessert. And he's like, no, we can't have desserts. And Garibaldi's like, well, fine, you were going to have any anyway. And then he gets really upset because he's like, wait, what is the dessert? I want to know what the dessert is. And Garibaldi's like, no, I'm not going to tell you. You can't have none.
It's probably something like tiramisu or something.
Yeah, it's something terribly bad for them. But it sort of becomes a learning moment, right? Because all the other characters, they know they can't eat this delicious, wonderful food all the time. But at the same time, like, Franklin has to realize, like, they're not all going to eat, like, salad all the time. It's not going to happen. Well, except for Ivanova, who will eat salad all the time. But, yeah. So, I don't know. I like that whole angle. It's sort of in the background. It's just a little thing that's there. It's secondary to the major plot, but it's fun.
Anyway. Yeah, and I think we, in Sheridan's relationship with Maynard, we see kind of him as a career military man, which kind of helps fill out the storyline where kind of he's missing his wife and talking with his sister. And we see the kind of the alternative lives that he has lived and would live if he could, and kind of Maynard as this mentor character. And then we also see, again, Sheridan stepping up and thinking unconventionally to try and bring the Cortez back with his expanding net of ships relaying information.
Yeah, I noticed this time watching through, Mike, how much Sheridan's tactical genius is being, which we will eventually get to, Sean, in real full cinematic color, is being laid here. It's like, yeah, he does think out of the box, and he does have interesting military solutions to problems that other people wouldn't think of. And yeah, we get those seeds we planted right here at the beginning of the season too.
Yeah, and I think in these episodes, there's a bit of a balance between make it clear that these characters kind of have interesting things going on and kind of have good insights, and balancing that against not kind of going over the audience's head. Because like with when the fighter kind of is spinning and fires back in the same direction, for me it takes a little too long for Maynard to clue in. You know, they do a full like two or three back and forths, which I take as being for the audience's sake more so than being really as representative for the characters. But I'm also biased because I've seen this, you know, I've seen that episode at least three or so times before. But I think that's just kind of a general TV thing of striking a balance between wanting the characters to be clever and not leaving the audience in the lurch.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's even probably even today, they probably would have, in today's television, they probably would have made that go through a little faster. One less back and forth beat than trusted the audience to get it.
Yeah, because like on cable, it could be almost right away. And on network, it'd probably be, you know, one or two back and forth instead of two or three.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I just say that, so in these four episodes, there have been some questionable acting. And Russ Tamblyn
is
one of those where, he's not the worst. The new president is the worst, who's in one scene in these four episodes.
Oh,
and
God.
I just honestly wanted him to stop talking because it was so bad. It was really bad. I wish he'd just written a letter. That would have been so much better. I also have just amused by Babylon 5 at times technologically, because there's that moment when Franklin is in this episode, right, is printing out what you can eat and what you can't eat. And I'm like, it's enormously inconvenient. It must cost so much money to send reams of paper for these machines to this place out in the middle of frickin' nowhere, which has no trees of its own to harvest, right? It's just like, I don't know. I know. I know a lot of older shows do that, right? It's like, we're still using paper when we're in deep space. No, we wouldn't use paper. Unless we recycled all the paper.
But they don't explicitly say, we're still using trees. So it could be space paper.
Maybe it's out of, everybody's human skin.
Like, there's any number of things it could be. Because we're not fully into replicator territory, but they've got some stuff going on. And yeah, I do think it's interesting to look back on shows that aren't intentionally retrofuturistic, but now they are from a different perspective.
Right.
Yep. I mean, in 10, 15 years, The Expanse, for example, is going to look retrofuturistic because just the way our technology is going to go that the show didn't predict.
Right. Because again, this brings up the quote that science fiction is about today. Because it's always a story for a today audience.
Right. It's not about the future. It's just set there. Yeah. Which Jen hates me for, but whatever.
Cool.
Because she has to deal with it. Anyway, so what do we think about the Cortez getting lost thing real quick? And then we got to move on to closing out the show. But, and you guys have any thoughts on that particular narrative?
It also provides the opportunity to give, Kepler his promotion too.
Right.
Yeah. I don't care about that character.
You probably shouldn't, but I just the fact that he stuck out like a sore thumb right from the beginning, I really noticed this time through. It was like,
I just don't notice his character. Like at the end, it's like, oh, they made him the commander of his little group. Okay. Like, woo. And then we're going to go on and I'm still going to forget who he is.
Yeah. He's no Starbuck.
He's not, nope. Right?
He's not Apollo or Starbuck.
If he had like a drinking problem, I'd remember him more, which is really sad that that's what I go to, but whatever.
Right. Well, because so many of these other leads are fairly efficiently characterized. Or at least we're used to them. So, like, we're a little bit more used to Sheridan than we are to Kepler because he's gotten so much more screen time. And then anybody who's survived from season one, we know a lot. And I don't think they necessarily play into the, like, who is this guy? Because all of the command staff know who Kepler is.
Yeah. I mean, even this episode, right, what we know of Sheridan, he gets a kind of a full development arc here where his whole conflict is, I'm a military man, what the hell am I doing on Babylon 5 doing all of this ambassador bureaucracy garbage, right? He gets mad. He actually gets irritated with people and tells them, like, don't, like, he tells Garibaldi, right? Like, leave me alone. Like, only come to me when something really important happens. And Garibaldi's like, but yeah, you told me to come to you about everything. And he's like, yeah, I don't give a shit. Like, go away. Right? But he changes at the end of this episode because he sort of gets a good talking to and realizing that what he's doing here is actually important.
He's in the place where the universe needs him to be.
Right, because it makes sense to have him struggling with that as Maynard shows up, because Maynard represents kind of this other life that he's gotten to have in the military and this thing that maybe he wanted. So it's, I think that contrast is well placed structurally, which is really nice.
Yeah, I really enjoy that part of the narrative. I thought that was really well done. And of course, it is, Delenn gives him a nice talk, which is nice.
She basically paraphrases Carl Sagan, but that's okay. You can paraphrase Carl Sagan.
She does.
Right.
She says star stuff. Yep.
Yeah. And they, we get a little bit of a different side from Sheridan, because we see him being a bit more contemplative, but not in a like talking to individual people. Like he's searching for something. Though we've had the kind of bit from earlier about how he's going to spend a lot of time in hydroponics because he likes oranges, right? So it's, there's a couple of cool bits here. I think now that we're into season two, I really feel like the plot, the long arc plot and the accumulation of characterization is starting to show up.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. Well, all right. So do we need to close this out because we've been going on long enough. We gotta go away, guys.
Yeah. So if you're listening and watching along, please go ahead and start watching that next disc over the next month or two, I guess, so that you can keep up on the conversation. And if you have cool thoughts or memories about maybe watching the show when it was first on or sharing it with friends, do please let us know on comments or hit us up on Twitter.
Yeah,
and we will read them. If you send us a little message, I'll happily we'll read some of your stories about your first experiences. Yeah, send them our way.
And if you just want to talk it to us, then you know, let us know that you'd rather not have it on the show. We're happy to get that feedback either way.
Yeah, happy to. So yeah, perfect. Obviously you can send us an email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com or Twitter is @skiffyandfanty. You can also find us on Patreon. We need like $1 million so we can take over the world. So if you go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty, you can support the show, and, you know, give us a dollar or whatever you feel comfortable with. Doesn't matter. Someone gave us like 52 cents. So, hey, whatever works.
We'll take it.
Yeah. We'll take anything. We also work for, cookies.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you see us at a convention, you give us cookies. We'll count that as payment and it's tax deductible.
Important safety tip.
Maybe. Yeah.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, so thanks for listening. Thanks, Mike and Paul, for doing this again. It's awesome.
Hooray.
And
hooray.
Thank you, Paul, for making sure to get this set up. I really appreciate it. You've been
thanks, man.
Taking on a little bit. So awesome. All right. So we'll see everybody next time.
Bye,
awkward all. Ending.
Good night.
And see. Our intro and outro music comes from Nocturnia by Psychedelic Pedestrian. You can find out more about them on freemusicarchive.org, including the full version of the song. We obviously made some edits to the song, including sound effects and, of course, shortening the length. You can also support us by going to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to send us a suggestion, you can do so at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, skiffyandfanty.com, and check out the little suggested topic form at the top there. You can also just send us emails. You can also find us on Twitter at @skiffyandfanty or on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Just search for us on there. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next time.